This episode of Guitar Radio Show is brought to you in part by
Geppetto Pickups, GeppettoGuitars.com. Guitar players are always searching for the tone that will define their playing identity. Geppetto Pickups' wide spectrum of tones and sonic colors inspire and instill a newfound confidence in the player that comes from having amazing tone. Go to GeppettoGuitars.com. We'll give your guitar its voice, but you'll make it sing.
Welcome to Guitar Radio Show, the show dedicated to the guitar player, guitar maker, gear builder, and purveyors of such items you may not know about, but should. Here's your host, Mark Davin.
All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Guitar Radio Show. Happy New Year, everybody. This is our first episode of the year, and we thought we've been talking about this particular subject for quite a while. Mr. Rob Wingler and I, and we thought we would start the year off with this particular subject. How are you, Rob? Welcome back.
Good, thank you. Welcome back. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year. So we're going to do an episode on architects. Architects of the guitar community, architects of genre, architects of, you know, people that change it. So our criteria is, where did it start? Or at least jumpstart a massive change in both music, style, pop culture, commerce, and trend. So that's kind of our criteria as far as that's concerned. So we're not going back to, you know, the very first lute player, you know, in 500 AD. Who played the lute for the first time in a church. We're gonna primarily keep it to electric guitars when electric guitars started and go back. Paul Reed Smith promised years ago, and I'm gonna hold him to it eventually, that he would come on this show and do the history of the guitar from 500 AD on. That means we would spend 2 weeks with Paul Reed Smith on the air. And I certainly hope we get to do that at some point. He had promised. He said he would do it, so I'm going to hold him.
He's a man of his word.
He is. He won't make a left-handed silver sky, but he's a man of his word. As long as he makes a left-handed DGT, I'm okay. Coming up this month, we've got some cool episodes. We've got a really cool encore episode with Tony McAlpine. And we're going to start a new series that we're going to run throughout the course of the year. It's going to be artist picks. And it's going to be some of my favorite guitar players are going to join us on the show and go through their top favorite, 10 top favorite albums and why. And the first person that we're going to do that with is somebody that is just, I can't believe I get to call him a friend. Mr. Andy Elidort is going to join us for that first one. So that's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to that. He actually texted me last night. He goes, "Get ready. I picked my top 10. I said, "Okay, I'm strapped in. I'm ready to go." So here we go. The criteria. Electric guitar. Electric guitarists. Early on, you know, I mean, we can talk about electric guitar, we talk about the Rickenbacker frying pan, right? We can talk about all that. Well, let's talk about the players. For me, I've always said if we had to narrow it down to three guitar players that single-handedly changed this criteria, like we said, changed in both in music, style, pop culture, commerce, and trend, I would pick the three would be Les Paul, Jimi Hendrix, and Eddie Van Halen. because of what they did and the amount of guitars that they personally sold. They're responsible for selling. That's how I feel about it with those three. But as we drill down into the rabbit hole and we dig down a little bit deeper, you know, it's going to be interesting because I have an interesting list here. I'm sure you do as well. What do you think?
I agree. Actually, my list was very almost exactly the same as yours with Les Paul and Hendrix and Eddie. And then I would probably add Eric Clapton on there too.
Really? From because of the Cream period or all the way through?
But definitely starting with the Cream period, he was making everybody want to play loud Marshalls, and he's responsible for the Blues Breaker combo.
That's true. That's true. I never really thought of it that way. So yeah, I would have to agree with that. Yeah, from the Cream period all the way into the Beano, John Mayall period.
Right.
Yeah. After that,
well, I think he sold a lot of Strats.
Certainly signature models.
Yeah.
Certainly signature models. Yeah, I think that's probably one of their best-selling Strats, I would imagine. Yeah, I would agree with that. Yes, absolutely. But as far as an entire career, I mean, you know, and granted, like you said the other day, we were talking off mic the other day, and Rob said something that was pretty salient. I never really thought about it before, what you said about Hendrix, that we didn't get to see, you know, the period that we saw, the periods that we saw with Eric Clapton with Jimi Hendrix, because Hendrix died so young.
Right.
So,
As I put it, he died at the right time. You didn't get Disco Hendrix. You didn't get Hendrix endorsing the new West tone, you know.
We didn't get Hendrix doing I Was Made for Loving You type of a thing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and you know, I think there's a lot of people out there would probably say there's no way that he would have done that. But, that's speculation. We don't know what he would have done. I mean, and I had mentioned to you, you know, that he had this really crazy, kooky idea that he had out there with doing something with Miles Davis and Paul McCartney just prior to his death. So who knows? I think, honestly, I don't think he would have gone poppier. I really don't. I think he would have gone weirder.
Right.
That's for sure.
You don't think we would have had any new wave Hendrix?
No, I don't. No. No, I don't. I think he would have... I think, honestly, in just gut feeling, I think he probably would have gone more the way of Adrian Belew.
Really?
Yeah.
I could see that. I mean, I could see that, but at the same point, I could see him joining Devo. So,
you know, heck, I could see Adrian Belew in Devo. So,
yeah, absolutely,
it would work. It would work. I mean, you know, I mean, Belew was in Talking Heads, so
right,
not that far a stretch, really. If you think, I love Adrian Belew. I think he's brilliant. All right, so go ahead.
Well, which would you like me to start with? Like, we can go all the way back to Chuck.
Yeah, let's go chronologically.
Okay, because, like, that's what I have. Chuck Berry, you know, invented rock and roll. So he created that whole...
Ooh.
That's my opinion, is that he invented rock and roll, and he created the whole, you know... I didn't say he created showmanship, because that goes back to, you know, T-Bone. But,
oh, yeah, he stole from T-Bone Walker in a huge way.
But he definitely brought it to the masses.
Yes, he did. Now, here's an interesting thing. Are you familiar with a guitar player by the name of Gory Carter? He's a Texas player.
No.
Okay, so he had a track. And what's the name of the track here? I have it here somewhere. Where is it? I have the name. I think it's called... Oh, it's not on this note. Rock a While. I'm glad I remembered. He had a track called Rock a While. It came out in 1948 or 49. Pre-Chuck Berry. It sounds like Chuck Berry.
I'll have to look it up.
Sounds just like Chuck Berry. Now, I don't know if Gory Carter had the same showmanship and all that stuff as Chuck or T-Bone Walker, for that matter. But when I heard Gory Carter, I was gobsmacked, only because, you know, I love Chuck Berry.
Right.
I was lucky enough to see Chuck Berry several times, and it was just astounding. I got to see him first. The first time I got to see him was 1988 at the Ritz in New York, and he was in fine form. He was really doing really well. The pickup band was wonky, but he was on top of it. And then I saw him many years later, probably about 20-something years later, and he was not in good place. He's not in a good place. He couldn't remember the lyrics. He was flubbing. The guitar was out of tune. He was opening up for Little Richard.
Huh.
Yeah, that night. And but it's funny, you know, you should say that Chuck Berry invented. Yeah, I guess from a guitar standpoint, you could say that, you know.
Right. Well, my logic to this was the path that I took was there's no Keith Richards without Chuck Berry.
This is true.
So that's where I was like, he is a genre changer.
Right, right. And I feel like there'd be no Joe Perry without Keith Richards and Jimmy Page.
And there'd be no Slash without Joe Perry. So you see?
So we're drawing our lines. And I'm sure there's going to be a lot of people pissed off about this. But hey, whatever. Opinions are like, you know what. Anyway. But yeah. And it's funny for me, from a reckless abandon standpoint, and that rock and roll in those times, in that time period, was about reckless abandon. It was about balls to the wall intensity. And yes, Chuck had that. But I still feel like the king of rock and roll is Little Richard.
Overall.
Songs, voice. I mean, Paul McCartney.
Yeah.
He says that he stole directly from Little Richard.
Oh, you can hear it, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Woos. Oh. Anytime Paul does his woos,
you know. Oh, yeah.
Little Richard.
It was all about Little Richard.
I was trying to keep this guitar-centric when I made my list.
Well, no, you're totally right. You're totally right. Absolutely. So, but yeah, Chuck. And, you know, and I have some notes here with Chuck. It's like, I think there was a lot of Cab Calloway, T-Bone Walker, Charlie Christian. And there are some that, you know, I remember hearing Chuck say that Nat King Cole was his favorite vocalist.
Really?
Yeah. Which you would never think.
No, I don't hear
it. You would never think, yeah. I mean, do you remember, I mean, it's like with David Bowie. Do you remember a singer from the 50s and 60s? He was like a Broadway guy. His name was Anthony Newley.
No,
he had a song called What Kind of Fool Am I? That was his big hit. What kind of fool am I?
I think I've heard the song.
Yeah. Well, he was David Bowie's biggest influence, and it's funny because if you go back and you listen to some of Anthony Newley, and then you listen to Bowie and you go, oh wow, he really did influence him. It's kind of crazy, but Bowie took it to another place, just like Paul took it to another place, Chuck took it to another place, and that's the whole thing here is that architectural. Model that we're looking at, right? But yeah, for sure. Chuck, I would definitely say with Chuck. Yeah, he's just, I mean, if I go a day without playing a Chuck Berry riff, there's a problem.
Right.
it's ingrained in me. Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. So go on.
Next, I went with Cream because I bypassed the Beatles. I figured that the Beatles and the Stones might be on your list, so I was trying not to make similar stuff. So I went to Cream because first power trio,
mm-hmm.
first super group, first to really meld jazz, blues, and freeform, you know, playing mm-hmm. with jams.
Mm-hmm.
So, which brings us to Eric Clapton being a game changer.
Mm-hmm.
Before Hendrix showed up on the scene, everybody wanted to be Eric Clapton.
That's true.
I mean,
and almost overnight.
Yeah, I know. So, but yeah, well, he said when he saw Hendrix, he wanted to smash his guitar.
Yeah, yeah.
Which I like Neil Peart. Neil Peart had a good saying. He said, I always read that Clapton said when he saw Hendrix play for the first time, he wanted to go home and smash his guitar. And he goes, I would have wanted to go home and play and practice to get better instead of smashing my guitar.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that was a good
quote. That's Neil Peart for you.
But before, you know... Hendrix came on the scene, Clapton was the guy. I mean, John Mayall talks about it all the time that, you know, because Clapton was in and out of that band because, you know, he would leave. And Mayall's like, I wanted him so bad that no matter who I had, like Peter Green would fill in when Clapton was out. Mm-hmm. And then Clapton would tell him, you know, 2 weeks later, I want to come back. And he's like, I had to fire Peter Green because I needed to have Eric Clapton in the band.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and plus, that's like the biggest influential band on me. So I had to put.
Really? Are they? I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. Jack Bruce is the whole reason that.
Yeah. That and you know, it's funny, you know, for real musicians, real people who are really into the music, really love it all, and understand it, have grasped the concept. Jack Bruce is somebody who is really revered, but most people don't really pay attention to it's all about Clapton or Ginger Baker, you know, whereas Jack Bruce was not only was he holding it down so the other two could do what they did, but he was doing this other thing.
Yeah, everybody was soloing at the same time, basically, but making it sound cohesive.
Unbelievable.
Right? Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, but without them, so if you go without Clapton, well, without Clapton, you got no Eddie Van Halen, you have really nobody. Anybody of note without Eric Clapton from that time period, you don't got Warren Haynes. You don't have, you know, like I said, Eddie Van Halen's his big influence. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No Sambora. Mm-hmm. No, it's everybody was influenced by that from, you know, the past. I don't know about kids today aren't influenced by it, but yeah. They should be.
Yeah.
And the first power trio, so no Government Mule, no Mountain. Mountain was, I mean, Felix Pappalardi was Cream's producer.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those songs that didn't make it, some of Jack's songs that didn't make it for Cream, Mountain did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that was next in line for me.
That totally makes sense from an architectural standpoint. I, you know, and I really never really considered Clapton as an architect, but I guess in some respects, as far as electrifying, taking the I shouldn't say electrifying the blues. I should say electric British blues, which is a completely different thing.
Yeah.
It really is. I mean, it's funny because the British always claim Jimi Hendrix as their own because, you know,
right.
You know, 3/4 of his band was British. But yeah. I don't know. I never heard British blues when I heard Hendrix, but whereas when I heard Cream, or I heard early Fleetwood Mac, you mm-hmm. know, or the John Mayall stuff. You know, that was definitely, there was a sound to it. Same with Zeppelin, British blues.
Well, know, actually,
and
since
the Yardbirds.
Since we talked about Mayall, maybe that's really the architect, because everything stems from that band.
Right. He was a curator.
Yeah.
Of putting those people together and being the taskmaster. Yeah.
True. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. All right, let me. So I catch up with you in the timeline. Let me go. I have here. I had Les Paul. I had Chuck Berry. Mm-hmm. And then I had somebody that you wouldn't normally think of, but he's just an astounding guitar player. And he was so white bread, and he was so squeaky clean, but yet every Sunday night at 7 or 8 o'clock, whenever the show aired, he was tearing it up. And it was Buddy Merrill from the Lawrence Welk Show.
Huh.
This,
I'll have to look up
this
video.
This is a guy that you would, you know, for you look at him and you go, okay, well, that's not going on. What's going on here? You know, he's, I mean, real clean cut, you know. But he went and he did this. He was just incredible. He was incredible. And he was really responsible for selling a lot of guitars, making, you know, especially clean cut kids. He made it okay, made it safe for the clean cut kids and the kids that weren't allowed to listen to rock and roll and had to be in church every Sunday, you know, because right. they even did some church music, to church style music on the Lawrence Welk Show. I remember my dad used to watch that show, and I was always kind of like, you know, I was like, this is the same guy who likes Johnny Cash and Hank Williams, who were notorious debauchery.
Right.
You know. But he would always point out to me, he would say, check out this guitar player. And he was the first guy I ever saw play a jazz master. He was the first guy, you know. But he was like a direct to me, was like this line that went from Lawrence Welk, the country sounding, kind of twangy, but played rock, played surf, to Roy Clark and Hee Haw and all that, you know?
Right.
So I'd go Buddy Merrill on the Lawrence Welk show. I had to put in the Beatles, you know, I mean, without Little Richard, Carl Perkins, and Elvis, you wouldn't have had the Beatles. So there's right. your architect. But the Beatles are probably, I think, out of everybody that we're talking about today, probably more responsible than anybody, maybe with the exception of Eddie, of having people run to the store, not walk, run to the store and buy and pick up a guitar and learn how to play.
I think that only is if you go by age. If you go by age groups, it's which one you hit that made you run out.
Yeah. Yeah, but I mean, well, generationally, that in that time period, and then Eddie later. I mean, I can't believe. I mean, I was when Eddie hit, I was teaching guitar and bass out of my house, and I can't believe how many kids started to show up with their moms right. and saying, "I want to learn how to play. I want to learn how to play." And I was like, "Okay, here we go," you know, and it was like. Kids coming in with Kramers and kids coming in with, you know, Strats and coming in with, you know, all and a lot of fat Strats. It was all about the fat Strat, you know. Mm-hmm. So I would go with the Beatles and then Jimmy. Jimmy is, you know, to me is undeniable. You know, I had sent you a video last night. Folks, I'm going to put this in the show notes. Jimmy's original guitar teacher from Seattle, his name was Billy Davis. There's some cool video you got to see, and there's a really cool interview with him about meeting Jimmy for the first time and everything else. But yeah, I think I honestly he's one of those people, Jimmy, to me that the electric guitar. He was the next logical step sonically for the instrument.
Right.
You know. Whether or not I'm sure he inspired a lot of people to pick up the guitar and play, but not in the same way that I think Les Paul did or the Beatles did or Eddie did. I think it's probably a less of an impact. I think he was more reaching people who weren't players to really appreciate music, especially right. different music, you know. But yeah, and then you think about. Jimmy said that his favorite guitar player, one of his favorite guitar players, or guitar player that was better than him, he said, was Terry Kath from yeah. Chicago. And just a brilliant guitar player who doesn't get the love.
He doesn't. And he's always in my Hall of Fame for worst guitar sound ever on 25-624.
You don't like that sound?
It's so dry and so it drives me nuts.
I
Him
love
and Randy
it.
Rhodes, they get the worst tone. Ever.
Yeah, I was never crazy about the mixes on the Ozzy records. The songs were phenomenal. The playing was incredible. The vocals were great. I mean, I think it's some of Ozzy's best vocals.
Right.
But
the guitar is very buzzy and tinny.
That production is very, very hard. Yeah. I'd love to go back and remix that record.
Right.
How dare you? How dare you? And then, of course, there's you know, and the guitar player that Jimmy said was his favorite was Billy Gibbons, at least according to Billy Gibbons. You know, well, I believe
why would
him.
He lie?
I believe him. I
exactly.
Believe him. So yeah, that takes me up to about 68, 69. What do you got?
That's about where I am at. Okay. So this is where I start with the Allman Brothers because they came out of.
Architects.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, explain to me. Why do you think, because I would not consider them architects.
They created Southern Rock. So without them, okay. You got no Skynyrd, you got no Blackfoot, you got no The Outlaws, you got none of that.
You got no Black Crows.
No. So,
but then you could say that no, without the faces, you got no black crow either.
I guess you could. Mm-hmm. But I think with the Allman Brothers, first twin guitars doing harmony solos and everything. Right. Uh-huh. So between Dickie and Dwayne, they come as one. I can't say either is the architect. It's the package. That package of the two of them is game changing.
You know, I never thought about it. Yeah, I never thought about it. You're right. Yeah, I would have never thought of the Allman Brothers as architects. So that would go into the category of change in music and style. Maybe not pop culture, commerce, or trend. Right. Maybe trend as far as trending in musicians. Mm-hmm. I'm with you on that. Okay, who else you got?
Same period, different genre.
Late 60s, early 70s. Okay.
Yeah, Tony Iommi and Black Sabbath.
Couldn't agree more.
Because, I mean,
they created a genre.
It's they are the architects of heavy metal.
They created a genre. That's, to me, that's really an architect. Somebody that changes, who creates a genre. You know,
right.
James Brown, architect.
Right.
Created a genre. That music did not exist in that form, that way, prior to him. Yes, there was Louis Jordan, there was, you know, people like that, but not like that and what he would spawn from that, you know. So, yeah, no, I totally agree with you. I totally agree with you. Black Sabbath are genre creators. Absolutely.
Now, in the same time period, because a lot of my stuff actually ended up being like from the 70s anyway. Mm-hmm. So, was King Crimson. They created prog rock to me.
You're right. Can't argue. Didn't think of them either. Yeah, Fripp and company. Absolutely.
So yeah. I was torn between going with them and Jethro Tull, but I went with King Crimson because I thought that was a little more proggy than Jethro Tull.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny that people consider Jethro Tull a prog band. I never really considered them a prog band.
Really?
No, I always thought of them as a rock band. I mean, but I guess they are. I guess they are a prog band.
Yeah, I guess they walk that line where they can go either way. But I mean, Thick as a Brick is a prog rock album to
mm-hmm.
me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you're right. You're right. All right. Let me give you some of mine.
Okay.
Going back again to 68, 69. Actually, probably even further back, 67. They started the MC5 out of Detroit.
Oh, yeah. Punk rock. It's rooted.
It really kind of starts there. And, you know, if you ask Iggy Pop how the Stooges got started, they got started by, I mean, there's a great documentary on Iggy. I can't remember the name of it. On the Stooges. It's so great. And he talks about the MC5 being like the big brothers to them, and that they would listen. They weren't allowed to come into the rehearsals, but they would stand outside and they'd listen, and they were like, that's what we want to do.
Right.
And the Stooges were created out of that influence of the MC5. So without the MC5 and the Stooges, which almost happened simultaneously, you wouldn't have the Ramones, you wouldn't have the Dolls, you wouldn't have the Sex. And then without the Ramones and the Dolls and the Talking Heads and early Blondie, you wouldn't have the Sex Pistols, you wouldn't have the Clash, you wouldn't have had the Dead Boys, you wouldn't have had any of those other bands. So it goes back to me, as far as an architect, it really goes back to the MC5 and the Stooges, more so the MC5. And then the Ramones picked up the ball and created this other thing. You know, there's a story that, and I've actually been in this club in London. It's in Camden. It's called Dingwalls. And it's the first place that the Ramones ever played. Malcolm McLaren brought the, I think it was Malcolm McLaren. I forgot who brought the Ramones over. No, Malcolm McLaren brought the Dolls over. Someone brought the Ramones over. They played at Dingwalls in Camden. And in that audience were future members, and some of them didn't even know each other yet, were future members of the Sex Pistols, the Clash,
Right.
And they were all big Ramones fans, and they were just totally there. From that moment, they were like, we've got to start a band right now. So that was the starter's gun in England for the punk movement. And then the Dolls came over. They were managed by Malcolm McLaren, poorly, I might add. But then, you know, if you look at the Dolls, you know, it'd be really cool to do a family tree, you know, sort of a thing of or a timeline. With the Dolls, I see, you know, Kiss. I see Aerosmith.
Right. You know?
And the Dolls were also kind of maturing in the same way that the Stones were, feeding off of the energy in New York at that time.
Right.
The energy in New York at that time. And I'm living there, I remember, as a kid, the garbage strike and the piling above your head on the streets of New York, because there was no garbage pickup, you know, and in a city of almost 7 million people at that time, you know, it got nasty, and it got nasty quick. And, you know, it was almost around the same time that Gerald Ford told New York to go fuck themselves, you know, that he wasn't going to, because New York was broke, and it was just, the crime was crazy. So that feeding off of that energy of the city, you got that sound that the Dolls had, that rough and tumble, you know, Chuck Berry infused, you know,
right.
Because Johnny Thunders was a huge Chuck Berry fan. You know, same with Keith, right? There's Chuck again, infusing with the energy of what's going on in New York and the desperate nature of it all. You had that sound. So, like, it's funny. I was listening to Hot Stuff off of Black and Blue, the Ramones, not the Ramones, the Rolling Stones record, my favorite Stones record. And there's a line in there, all you people in New York City, I know you're struggling, but you're tough, you know? And, you know, same with Shattered, the lyrics in Shattered. Go ahead, bite the big apple. Don't mind the maggots.
Right.
So, yes, I think there's that. There's all that fallout from the MC5, and then later on Kiss. And then, you know, I would say Kiss is an architect from a standpoint of the big rock show.
I had them on my list, too.
Okay. The Ace big Freely. Rock show. I mean,
Ace Frehley. I mean, when you ask people, it's usually around that time period, they say Eddie made me want to get, you know, a guitar, or Ace Frehley. Like,
yeah.
If you get people a little before, it's Ace Frehley. And mm-hmm. Ace Frehley sold a lot less Pauls. I know, because he made me want my first one.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Tobacco Sunbursts. Yeah.
And sold a lot of t-shirts, and they sold a lot of coffins, and
yeah.
They could put faces on.
They were all about, they were so, it was, you know, and a lot of that was Billy Coyne, obviously, you know, but he taught them, you know, they were all about the big show. I mean, you know, Garth Brooks has a show like he has because of Kiss.
Oh, yeah, he's a huge Kiss fan.
Huge Kiss fan. Smashes a guitar, he has fire, he has fog, he has a crazy light show.
Right.
And he's playing country music. So, yeah, I mean, without them, you wouldn't have the big rock show. And, yeah, I mean, well, Dimebag, right? Dime said, he cited Frehley and Eddie.
Yeah.
Right?
Same thing with Snake Sabo.
Eddie and Frehley?
Yeah, Frehley and Eddie.
Interesting. That's interesting. So I would go with that. And then we're getting into the 70s, I'd go with the Runaways.
Okay.
You know, they were the first band to do that for their gender.
Mm-hmm.
And kick open the doors. You know, I mean, yeah, you had Dolly Parton, you had Patsy Cline, you had Brenda Lee, you had the Supremes, you had all that, but not, you know, you didn't have women who was spitting on stage and playing,
right.
You know, playing a melody maker, beating the shit out of a melody maker. I mean,
without them, would you say there'd be like no Go-Go's and no the Donnas? And
absolutely, there'd be no L7. that went out there. The Runaways were complete architects for. They literally didn't press up against the glass ceiling. They smashed it,
right?
And there was nothing left of it. And those records, the first two records are just fucking amazing. They're brilliant. They're great records. They're so heavy. They're so good. They're so catchy. You know, they weren't a great live band. They were a little sloppy live.
But yeah,
I think they're super important. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I see it. I mean, I like I said, no Go-Go's, no Donna's, no Lita Ford. I mean, Lita Ford's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you know, and Joan. Joan is, honestly, she is the epitome of, I think she's the epitome of rock and roll.
She really is. Cultural icon.
And sure. Super cool person.
Yeah.
Such a great person. Yeah. I got to sit with her. We were rehearsing in the same studio together in 1986 when the Mets won the World Series.
Nice.
And we watched the World Series together. My band, her band.
Huh.
We sat and we watched the World Series. Everybody stopped rehearsing just so we could watch the band, watch the game. We literally paid $25 or $30 an hour to watch the Mets win the World Series.
Well, it was cheaper than buying a ticket to go, right?
I think it was. Yeah, absolutely. That was a fun night. But she's fantastic. I love her. Love her. Yeah. So we already said Sabbath. What do you think about? I've heard people say that before Sabbath, and just before Sabbath, was Blue Cheer.
I knew you were going to say Blue Cheer. I don't think they were big enough to be architects.
But did they create the sound first?
No, not the Sabbath sound is so much heavier. The Blue Cheer sound more punk rockishy to me than the Sabbath sound is like nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing else before it had that I don't know, almost frightening sound. Right? It's a little bit, if you think about when those records came out, those early records, the imagery and the sounds are frightening.
Oh, yeah.
Compared to the Beatles.
Yeah, just the title track of the first record.
Yeah.
I mean, it's literally, you know, I mean, yeah, they got it from Boris Karloff movie. But man, let me tell you, game changer, complete game changer. Yeah. I mean, you know. And now it's so funny because, like, I love doom metal,
right?
I love doom metal, but really, what it is, it's Black Sabbath.
It's just reiterated in different ways.
And some of it's just brilliant. I just love it, like Wofat out of I think they're out of Dallas,
and the Sword is out of Texas.
I love the Sword. Cadaver out of Germany. I mean, just killer bands. Yeah, absolutely. All right, so we covered the Blue Cheer thing. Okay, where are you at now?
A little bit earlier, but in the same timeline. But I can't do a list without mentioning this guitar player because he's like my second favorite of all time. And without him, he created a whole style. It's Deep Purple and Ritchie Blackmore. He's the first to bring that classical influence into playing. Without him, no neoclassical. You got no Yngwie, Randy. Eddie Van Halen cited him as a big influence, so right there.
You're definitely drilling down a little bit more, but yes, I agree with you. There would be no neoclassical vibe without Ritchie Blackmore. Yeah, and I've always wanted to ask you: out of all the Blackmore projects, and there have been many,
mm-hmm.
What has been your favorite? Purple or Rainbow or...
As a whole, the first Rainbow record is my favorite thing that he's ever done.
With Dio.
Yes, the very first one.
Mm-hmm.
And then, but as a whole, it's the Deep Purple stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So, but the first Ritchie Blackmore's Rainbow record is on constant rotation all the time. It's like a huge influence on me.
Mm-hmm.
ever since I was like 14 when I discovered it. Mm-hmm. So, but Deep Purple is my favorite project that he ever did. All of those records I love. You know, the stuff of Coverdale, any time period of that, I can listen to nonstop.
Yeah, and he's always had great singers.
Yeah, and he never gets along with any of them. Except for, I guess, his wife. That's his current singer, right?
Well, so yeah, he's got no choice. he always had great singers. Great singers, you know. And I always thought it was wild that, you know, here, you know, like when he, well, no, I think he was already gone. Was he already gone by the time, well, with Glenn Hughes and David Coverdale? Was he?
No, he played with Glenn Hughes and Coverdale.
And Byrne, and then, right?
Right.
Okay.
They did two records. And then, what's his name, came in? Bolan.
Well, Tommy Bolan.
Yeah.
One of my all-time favorite guitar players.
Right. And they did, what was that, Come Taste the Band, and I think a second record with him. They did at least one. I forget if they did two. Those are...
Yeah, they're okay. I mean, it's Tommy.
Right.
You know, there was no way that, you know... did you ever hear that Live in Japan with Tommy on there and Glenn Hughes and David Coverdale?
Yeah.
I have it as a bootleg. I got it years ago.
I think you sent it to me.
Did I send it to you?
I think you did.
Yeah. It's great, but there's no, you know, there's no Ritchie Blackmore in there.
No, you need listen, I like when Steve Morris was in the band. I like those records.
Yeah.
I listen to them. I like Steve Morris.
Me too.
I've seen them live with Steve Morris. It's without Ritchie Blackmore, it doesn't have the thing. It's, you know, that thing.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, he was really kind of the focal point.
Yeah. Know?
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, it's his and Lord's band, so...
Yeah. All right, go on.
Where were we? So we're in the 70s. At this point, that brings us right up to Eddie Van Halen coming out. And that you know...
changes everything.
There is... history goes, there was before Eddie, there was guitar playing after Eddie.
That's true. It's true. Yeah, and here's something that's really interesting. And for years, all of my friends in L.A. would say to me, especially in the mid to late 80s when I'd go out there and play or go to the NAMM show, they would always say, have you met Steve Lynch? And I go, no, not yet. And then I had the opportunity to meet Steve Lynch from Autograph.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, when I had hair... and I was still cute. He and I, it was kind of weird. I didn't notice it. But we took a picture together. I have it somewhere. I'll have to send it to you. And somebody said, do you realize you two look exactly alike? Like we were, I was like, no, I don't see it. And Steve was like, no, I don't see it either. But people would say to me all the time, that Steve Lynch was really the one who came up with that two-handed tapping and was doing it way before Ed.
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that?
I've heard that story. I've heard him say that before on some interview I read where he had said that he was basically doing that. But Eddie brought it to the masses. And Eddie said that he got it from... he saw Jimmy Page do it. When Jimmy Page just said... he doesn't remember ever doing anything like that.
I saw Jimmy doing this, but not this.
And he says that he saw him hit it with his other finger, and he went home and did it, and then he perfected it.
So I don't know that.
Steve Lynch might have been doing it, but nobody perfected it and brought it out like Eddie did, to where everybody heard that eruption and went, they playing a synthesizer?
What I thought it was. That's exactly what I thought it was. Absolutely. Yeah, for sure. I thought it was some sort of keyboard.
It sounds like Edgar Winter, you know.
Yeah, for sure. I was talking to Brad Tolinsky about that. He and I were both like, "What, you know, what was that?" You know. But yeah, no, for sure. And the thing about Ed too was you ever notice like after it was like sort of like what David Lee Roth said, you know. after Van Halen hit, everybody started to dress alike, look alike, sound alike. Because, you know, it was incestuous, you know. Mm-hmm. This is, and what happens with it, with incest, you end up with retarded kids, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, it's an un-PC term, but I'm using
it. We're going to get canceled.
Well, you know what? David said it. I didn't say it. I'm just repeating it. It's true. It really is true in the sense that there were so many players that were employing that technique, but the music behind it,
it just didn't
make the same musical sense that, I mean, literally, you listen to an Eddie Van Halen solo a couple of times and you can sing it, you can hum it.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's the song within the song.
Well, and that's why, as our list progressed, I didn't come up with anything really for the 80s, because everything after that just, Eddie, that's what everybody was doing, was sounding like Eddie.
Yeah.
I like the quote where Eddie says, somebody said to him, man, you're a great guitar player. He said, you should see me play keyboards. Before they did 1984, so it was early on, he said, you should see me play keyboard. And I mean, that's when you see how he plays. He plays it like a piano player. Like Michelangelo Badio plays it like a piano player.
Right.
A piano, but he has all that dexterity in both hands.
Right.
A piano player. And
right.
That's that Eddie is doing. But, I mean, he just did it on 11. And
yeah,
that's it. After that, everybody had single pickup Kramers and this and that. And everything sounded like bad copies of that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was no innovation until the opening chords of Teen Spirit, to me. I didn't hear anything in the 80s where, short of maybe Prince, different genre, Prince, total, you know, pop culture,
mm-hmm.
icon, that funk R&B
mm-hmm.
mix. There's nothing else like him. But other than that, do you have anything in the 80s where you're like...
No, I mean, really, like with Ed, it literally was the definition of our criteria today. You know, it changed trends. It changed commerce. It changed music, and started to seep into all these other different areas of music. You know, you had. He showed up on a Michael Jackson record.
I know.
You know, I mean, you know, it's. It's
and
amazing.
Didn't get paid for it.
And didn't get paid for it. Imagine if he would have got points on that.
Yeah, can you imagine? But he kindly just did it. He just, like, I did it.
Well, you said he was. I think he was there for 90 minutes, right?
Yeah, and so you know that noise right before the solo comes in on Beat It, there's a boom, 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 boom.
Yeah.
They were recording, and the janitor came and knocked on the door. And they just sent the whole thing over, and Quincy Jones did that record.
Yeah.
He heard it on there. It was perfectly timed. He left it on. So when you hear right before that solo, you hear doom, 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 doom. That goes, wah, wah, wah. That's the janitor knocking to see if he can come in and clean while they were recording that part.
I did not know that.
Yeah, it's crazy.
That's
but it's like
three
times, and they just left it in.
That's insane.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah, you're right. There isn't a lot that happens after that throughout the course of the decade, with the exception of Prince...
there's Prince, and I wrote down Ministry because they came out in the 80s, and there's mm-hmm. no industry without mm-hmm. Ministry.
That's true.
Other than that, I can't think of anything else that made me go, oh yeah, no, everybody wanted to do this.
Yeah.
Or people started playing this way. Everybody just wanted to sound like Van Halen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a big bandwagon. That was kind of unfortunate. I mean, there was a lot of, you know, the thing about the 80s too, it was a lot of party music. It was good time, you know, ain't nothing but a good time.
Right.
You know, everybody was feeling good and it was fun. I mean, I was there. It was a blast. It was a great party, you know.
Oh, yeah. And I like the music. I like, mm-hmm. you know, I listen to a lot of it all the time, but mm-hmm. none of it is like, not like that. Like
no,
I said,
a lot of it doesn't
historically,
stand. Yeah.
Historically, it's two dates. The day before Van Halen released and the day after, and that's it.
You're right. I agree with you. That's from an architectural standpoint, absolutely. I agree. There's somebody that we didn't mention that I would want to mention would be Bob Marley.
I had him as a side note. I didn't mm-hmm. I didn't work my way to bring him up. But yes, that is reggae.
Yeah, that is the he's sort of like the Van Halen of reggae in the sense that there was reggae before him, Rastafarian music.
Completely different after him. Yeah. And look, it made Eric Clapton want to do a reggae record.
And it certainly influenced the Stones in a huge way.
Oh, yeah, and the Police.
Well, see, then that's an interesting thing, too. There's an interesting band that we should talk about. From an architectural standpoint, in the sense that they blended, and it was because of, and they were products of their environment. You know, they were playing in clubs, and I heard Andy Summers say this, that they were playing in clubs where on the same bill in an evening, and the crowds would shift in and out, and then eventually they started to just, everybody started to coalesce. There'd be punk bands on the bill, and there would be reggae bands on the bill. And from that was born the Police and their sound of melding punk and reggae or ska, you know. And then there were ska bands later on, like Madness and the Specials. I mean, I love those two bands. They were so much fun, and they were taking that reggae sound, that punk vibe, slamming, you know, putting the chocolate in the peanut butter, so to speak.
Right.
You know, but yeah, it's so interesting that, you know, you would get Madness and you'd get the Specials, and then you'd get something completely different, like the Police, and that all descended from Bob Marley.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah. That's interesting. Yeah, for sure. Let's see. What else you got? You can jump in the 90s?
I'm jumping to the 90s, unless you could think of anything in the 80s where you were like, this changed this or that. I mean, production-wise, you know, there's a lot of stuff that was... you know what? I didn't think of
it. Oh, yeah, the gated snare drum.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Everything was getting gated.
There's two, I guess, game changers in the 80s would be Steve Vai and Satriani with their records that came out.
Yeah, but they were variations on a theme in many respects to Eddie.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a lot of Eddie lifted.
But they were doing their own thing. I love Satriani because he's so melodic. It's songs. I mean, these are really, honestly, these are songs that could be top 40 songs if they had a vocal on top of it.
Right.
You know what I mean? He writes like that. And then he plays these, he's this just amazing stuff on top of it. Steve, on the other hand, you know, because of that Zappa influence, you know, and his work with Zappa is incredible. I mean, have you ever heard from... Witch arriving too late to save a no ship arriving too late to save a drowning witch record. It's a song called the Jazz Discharge Party Hats.
I've heard Keneally perform that.
Okay, yeah, Keneally, and we talked. Mike and I talked about this. He performed it. He's the only one who's ever performed it, played it, and sang it.
Right.
Because originally the recording of that was a rap that Frank did live, and then Steve later in the studio played against it. So it's okay. The Jazz Discharge Party, that whole thing, right?
Right.
And but nobody, they had never done it live,
right,
until
right.
Keneally. And yeah, so but the fact that Keneally can sing it and play it at the same time.
Oh, he's
only proves that he's freak bionic. Of nature. He's bionic. He's bionic. That's exactly right. But yeah, so yeah, I would agree. I would say yes. During the 80s, you had those guys doing their thing, and you know, and then of course you had your, you know, Jason Becker. You had Eric Johnson hit the scene. Marty Friedman, you know. But I wouldn't call them architects.
Yeah, and short of Eric Johnson, Marty Friedman, Jason Becker, it's all got Van Halen infused in it.
Absolutely.
So, you know, though, we didn't talk about Metallica. That would come up in the 80s.
Okay, there's that to me is an architectural band in the sense that they took a genre and helped create an adjacent genre, thrash.
Right.
You know, along with the Big Four, Anthrax, Slayer,
and Megadeth.
I'm sorry, I can't. Yeah. To me, and even though they were a little bit later, only by 6 months to a year, right. I would put Testament in there over Megadeth.
Personally. I think that's a valid point.
Personally. I think Testament's a way better band than Megadeth. Oh my God, what did he say?
Well, out of the Big Four, Megadeth is number four.
There's a reason they're number four. But yeah, no, I would agree with you entirely that Metallica, once again, that's another starting gun.
Yeah, I think that, you know, they took metal and thrash and made it own and made it so that everybody else afterwards wanted to sound like that.
Right. And then speaking of that, people that wanted to sound like somebody and took it to another place, where do you sit on the whole idea of the... when 90s metal started to do its thing, change the way it changed, the new metal, NU metal scene, because I have an architect for that scene.
Okay. When it was happening, and I was younger, I hated it. I was like, this is garbage. I'm listening to hot garbage, and it's all over the place, and, you know... it was not for me. But I'm listening to it, you know, what are we, like 25 years removed from it now? And I'm like, you know what? Not as bad as I thought it was.
Right. I agree with you.
At the time, I'm like, this is no, you know, Van Halen. This is no...
well, it had no melodic nature to it.
Nothing. No. But now I listen to it, I'm like, Fred Durst ain't so bad.
Wes Borland's a great guitar player.
I saw them live when they were like nobodies, just by happenstance, and I'm like, this is terrible. I saw them in System of a Down, and I was like, this is pretty terrible. And now I'm like, oh, not so bad.
Well, I consider King's X to be the architect of what would later become nu metal.
Really?
Yeah.
You'll have to walk me through this.
Okay, so, you didn't have a lot of people using the drop D tuning. That sound, that very thick, saturated sound. Yeah, I mean, Metallica was doing it, and so was Anthrax, but not in that same way. There was more air in the between the notes. Whereas with King's X, it's very saturated. There's not a lot of air between the notes, so there's a lot of... it's just thick, you know?
Yeah.
And that's what we ended up later on with, you know, I mean, like Pantera and bands like that, very thick.
Right.
Black Label Society. I think it came from, honestly, you know, from that. They kind of hit the starting gun on that whole scene, I think. And they didn't get enough credit. And I think there's a lot of bands out there that would say that from that time period.
But how do we get from... Black, not Black Flag, I'm sorry. I was thinking of their song, King's X. I was thinking of their song, Black Flag. How do we get from King's X to Limp Bizkit and Korn? Because I consider that is like new metal.
Well, I think that is a derivative of Anthrax teaming up with Public Enemy. Doing, Field of Noise, you know.
Man, when it was going on, see, when Field of Noise came out, I was like, this is cool. When Korn came out, I'm like, what the hell is this?
That, to me, honestly, I think if Anthrax wouldn't have done that, I don't think that would have been Korn in the way that we got Korn.
Right.
I think that was really a moment. I think that was another starter's gun.
I mean, like I said, I can appreciate it now. When it was going on and I was younger, I was like, I don't get this. Like, I just didn't get it at all.
Like, I got some of it.
At least, you know.
Not all of it.
But, I mean, since we're moving chronologically and we're getting to that 90s stuff, mm-hmm. got to talk about the grunge era, mm-hmm. which actually, I guess, so most people would say it's Nirvana and Kurt Cobain, and I get that, but grunge really started with Mudhoney, like 1988-ish. Mm-hmm. That's real grunge to me. Mm-hmm. See, I never considered like Pearl Jam and Alice in Chains and Soundgarden grunge bands, even though they were from that area. They weren't the grunge bands to me. They were rock bands.
They lumped in. I thought, when I first saw Alice in Chains, I thought they were a metal band.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. They were hard rock. Yeah. They were not. Grunge to me has always really been like Mudhoney, Nirvana's grunge, Screaming Trees falls into that.
Screaming Trees definitely falls into that.
Ad is grunge.
What was that band out of the Mojave Desert?
Bias?
Yeah.
So
they're metal / grunge.
I always felt that they were more in the stoner rock.
Okay.
Category with like with like Monster Magnet,
yeah, and what would later become Doom.
Yes they're the architects of Doom.
Yeah, maybe they are. Yeah, Caius is the what a great band.
Oh yeah,
you know, that's one thing you can say about Dave Grohl. He's got great taste in music.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I love that guy. Great. He turned me onto that band when I saw him in an interview on MTV. And right. They were asking him who he was listening to, and that's all he would ever talk about. And I went and I listened, and I was like, holy shit, this is incredible. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I agree with you, though. Yeah. I think that to put Alice in Chains and Soundgarden in the grunge, or Pearl Jam for that matter, in the grunge thing, I think they just got lumped in.
Just because they were from that area of... You know,
yeah, the geography threw them in there.
They were hard rock bands to me always. Mm-hmm. It was mm-hmm. them. I mean, as people argue, the Smashing Pumpkins are grunge, and I don't see that either. I think they're more of the alternative rock, which is Addiction. Really, is what started that for me. Is
James Addiction?
Addiction is the architect for that alternative rock stuff. So all that stuff got lumped basically together. But it's really like three different subgenres and categories.
I agree.
So, with a different architect for each category.
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. What else you got?
Let me see.
See, we take notes here, folks. That was the sound of his, for those of you listening, that was the sound of his 5x7 index card.
Isn't that funny? I use index cards.
I used to do legal pads. Now, as a matter of fact, I just threw out 10 years of legal pads the other day. Now I do everything in notes on my iPad.
So the rest of them aren't in like any order, the last couple. They would take us back to different eras, because like going to the Mahavishnu Orchestra for fusion.
So that would, you have to go back to the 70s. very early 70s. Yeah.
So, but I would put them down as architects for that whole fusion movement.
Yeah.
So Miles Davis is technically the architect.
Yeah, I think you'd have to say Miles Davis. Yeah.
I was trying to keep guitar centric.
Yeah, and then Mahavishnu, and then from that, Jeff Beck wanted to do that.
Yeah, but you got Return to Forever with Di Meola because that came out before Beck's. You know,
oh yeah, no, for sure. But I'm saying, what I'm saying is, when Beck heard John McLaughlin and the Mahavishnu Orchestra, that's when he said, "Oh, I want to do this." And that, I mean, honestly, you listen to Blow by Blow, mm-hmm. and it's it's a brilliant record. I love the record, but it's not Mahavishnu Orchestra.
No, but I mean, he got the keyboard player from it to play
he
on.
He got the elements.
So, you know, it's there.
Right.
But that's where it came from was Mahavishnu.
Well, he made it also more accessible.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I mean, if you go back, go look at the record sales between the two records.
Oh, yeah. No, you know,
and he had probably one of the greatest producers that ever walked the planet to produce the record, too. So he had George Martin. So.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Isn't it amazing, off topic, but on topic, when you think about it, Beck, Page, and Blackmore, Blackmore talks about this, mm-hmm. their three playing styles are very refined, very educated sounding, as opposed to like Clapton's a little more raw, Hendrix is a little more raw, Pete Townshend's a little more raw, mm-hmm. Iommi. Mm-hmm. Those three guys, Blackmore talked about it in his documentary where he said the three of them grew up in the same town. Mm-hmm. They were better off people. They were in their families were, I don't want to say well-to-do, but they weren't in Birmingham and Liverpool.
Middle class, upper middle class.
So he said, we got proper lessons because they were all friends. And he said, well, Blackmore hates Page for plagiarism reasons or whatever he says, but they were friends. And he said, because they grew up, in a more affluent neighborhood, they got proper lessons. Mm-hmm. And that's why they were studio musicians and this. And I think Holdsworth was in that same group, too, with them. So interesting how you see the difference when they all came out. But economically speaking, those three sound way more refined compared to the rawness of the I don't want to say less educated or less, just from the more urban area.
Right. Less trained.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Both sound.
Yeah. For sure. Yeah. I never thought of that.
Yeah. It was an interesting statement when he made that in his documentary that the three of them are from the same town, basically.
Yeah. Yeah. Huh. That's interesting. So what else you got?
If you went back to psychedelic rock.
Okay.
I wrote the 13th Floor Elevator.
Absolutely. There's no question.
So that was the...
right here in Austin, Texas.
Right. That's who started all that.
Yeah. Right here in Austin. They were making acid tabs in the science department at UT,
right,
University of Texas, right here in Austin, and they were dropping acid and they were doing Rory Erickson, and then they came to Moving Sidewalks with Billy Gibbons,
right after that,
and then from there I don't know if it was at everybody over in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury scene started to hear about what was going in Austin, or if 13th Floor Elevators went to San Francisco to play, or I don't know how it got spurned there, how it all spawned over there. But that, and it's funny because most people, when they think of psychedelic rock, they think of San Francisco.
Right.
And that's not the case at all. But yeah, you're entirely right. Absolutely. Absolutely. For sure. All right. Well, go ahead.
You got anything else?
No, you covered it.
Oh, good, because that's the end of my list.
Okay, you nailed it. Yeah, you nailed it. Now, I totally agree with you on the '90s stuff for sure.
Although, I guess if we got more recent, you would have to like real recent.
Okay.
With like the modern music, would mm-hmm. you say like the architect of modern music would be Periphery? And the whole
Polyphia.
Polyphia is one. Periphery with Misha Menshor and
okay.
I don't know what that is another. But that whole scene.
Mentone and Abbasi.
Yeah.
I think that's architectural, and I think it's something that has yet to. We need to see where it's going to go.
Right.
See if it's actually going to become a thing.
I only bring up Tosin Abbasi because he's got freaking guitars made by Ibanez, mm-hmm. Ernie Ball, mm-hmm. and his own, and they're crazy designs, mm-hmm. and seems like people are really flocking towards.
Well, same for Polyphia. I mean, Tim Henson has his own models. The other guy has his own models as well. So, yeah, no, I definitely think that's an indicator as to where things could be going. It'd be interesting to see what happens in the next 2 to 5 years regarding that.
Right.
Tim
Hitt is going to single-handedly eradicate boomer bends.
Not in this house.
I love Boomer Benz.
I find that album absolutely fascinating. It is really amazing to listen to. And, you know, it's funny because I actually have some notes about this somewhere. Yeah, here it is. This is what I wrote about them. I was going to put this in a blog. I say they're truly excellent. Whether or not they are the future of guitar music, I can't say. Their music has been largely ornamental in hip-hop, R&B, modern R&B. So I think the casual listener doesn't really know what they're hearing. And to be quite honest, the casual listener probably doesn't care.
Right.
From a guitar standpoint. For us guitarists, however, this is certainly a different way of looking at it. Having said that, I think it would be great if the aforementioned guitarists go and listen. I'm talking about Tim Henson and those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Go and listen to forerunners of what I think of forerunners of their genre, like Charlie Hunter,
okay,
Wayne Krantz, you know, Adrian Belew,
mm-hmm.
Robert Fripp. Mm-hmm. These are, to me, are forerunners of what they're doing. When I hear their music, I hear Fripp, I hear Belew, I hear Charlie Hunter, I hear Wayne Krantz, I hear elements of it. So whether or not they even know that these guys exist,
right?
It comes from somehow it comes from there.
Oh, you know what? You got to try to get Tim Henson on the show so you can ask him, because I'd like to hear who his influence is and if his influence was influenced by Robert Fripp. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because let's say he doesn't go that far back in his.
He probably doesn't.
Whoever he got it from, I wonder if that's where they got it from.
Be interesting to know.
Right?
Yeah. But yeah, so that's kind of what I think. But, you know, and I think I finish this up by saying, you know what they say about history, you got to know where you've been to know where you're going.
Nice, yes.
So, you know, yeah, I really, when I heard that record, I really digested the record for like 2 days. And then I wrote that. Because, you know, it really kind of hit me. I was like, well, I'm hearing Krantz. I'm hearing Hunter. I'm hearing Fripp.
Belew. Right.
You know, for that matter, I'm hearing some McLaughlin in there as well.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back to listen to it with these fresh thoughts in my mind about where it's coming
from. It's a great record. I think a record is phenomenal. I really do.
You turned me onto it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I love when somebody does something different with the guitar. You know, it's one of the reasons why I love Jeff Beck, because he's always trying to do something different, even if it doesn't always land well.
Right.
You know, sometimes he'll do something and be like, oh, okay, that didn't.
like
18.
Johnny Depp.
Like the 18 record.
Yeah.
There's moments on there that it's like pure Jeff Beck, and it's wonderful, and it's astounding. And you say to yourself, oh my God, how did he do that?
Right.
And then there are other times that you say with that record, there are other times that you say, why did he do that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, but he's still, to me, the best on the planet. I think. Anyway, I know for you, it's Blackmore.
Blackmore. So. It was Eddie, but he's no longer on the planet. So it's Blackmore.
Yeah, Eddie, man. Okay. What were you going to say?
No, I was going to say, because that's my Mount Rushmore is.
Yeah, let's get into the Mount Rushmores. So, I texted Rob last night. I said, okay, let's talk about Mount Rushmores. And we're going to do two different Mount Rushmores, and then he's got some more that he'll share with us. But we're going to do these two. And oh, actually, you know what? Before we do that, hang on. I have some. Mm-hmm. I went to social media, where, you know, I mean, everybody knows there. Right. And I asked some people, I just put it out there about architects. So let me read you some of the architects, and then we'll get into the Mount Rushmores. Cool.
Okay. Yeah. Perfect.
Okay. Here we go. So one guy said Rush. Okay.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. One guy said Pink Floyd, The Police, The Beatles, Moody Blues, Jethro Tull. All had a uniqueness and sound that only they could create, incorporating orchestra music to reggae influence. These were some of those acts. Okay.
Well, we had some of them mentioned. Yeah. The Police and the Beatles and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Here's a good one. I'd add Chuck Berry, Holdsworth. We didn't talk about Alan Holdsworth.
I had him on the side as a side note, yeah. Holdsworth, but I didn't know how to work him in as what genre that he changed.
Yeah, I mean, is it jazz? Is it prog?
And to me, McLaughlin came first.
Yeah.
So if you go to fusion, I had to go with John McLaughlin.
Right, but Holdsworth meant an awful lot to Eddie. Let's see here. Beatles, Zeppelin, Police, Marley, Donny Hathaway, Stevie Wonder, Patsy Cline, Billie Holiday, Sinatra, Hendrix, Page, Eddie Van Halen, Pat Metheny, Bill Evans, John Coltrane, Joe Pass. I mean, okay. Mm-hmm. Let's see what else we got here. Steve Vai, Joe Satriani, Yngwie Malmsteen, John Petrucci, Eric Johnson. They have developed their own voice in guitar. Don't forget Alex Skolnick. But, once again, they are descendants of...
Right. I mean, I had Yngwie, but when you trace it back, he's just really Blackmore on steroids.
Right. Right. So that's going to piss off some people, boy. You just pissed off some people.
You can feel free to email me.
No, don't email him. Put it in the comments below. All right. I like this one. This guy was really, really thought about this. Les Paul pioneered solid body guitars and multi-track recording. I couldn't agree more. Mm-hmm. John Lennon pioneered the use of rotating speaker for vocals and guitar. Pioneered flanging. The Runaways, first all-female punk band. I guess they were a punk band, but I thought they were more of a rock band. Noki Edwards pioneered surf guitar style pickup and guitar design.
Right.
That's, yeah. I mean, you
I
know,
didn't think to put him on. I had Dick Dale written down.
Dick Dale, too, yeah. But Noki Edwards, yeah. You can't.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, the Ventures were big time.
Yep. The Shags, worst band of all time. Nirvana helped mainstream punk and post-punk. Pixies pioneered quiet, loud songwriting structure. Joy Division helped to seed and inspire punk in the UK. Okay. The Ramones helped to seed and inspire punk in the US and the UK, to me. Igor Stravinsky created mass hysteria through modern music. Absolutely. Absolutely. This is important. This, and he's totally right, and we totally didn't have it in here. Sister Rosetta Tharpe invented rock and roll, released the first rock record. Not wrong, but that is also Ike Turner, who really had the first, but Rocket 88, first real rock record. But they also say, he invented distortion and fuzz. Because there was a mess up with the board on that session. Chuck Berry popularized rock and roll. Dick Dale invented surf music. The Beatles. The Trash Man released of the first punk record. That'd be interesting to go back and look at, but yes. The Rolling Stones pioneered fuzz. I would say Jimi Hendrix did that first. I mean, yeah, you would say that with... you definitely could say that with Keith using that cassette recorder. But he used a cassette recorder to record on an acoustic guitar.
For the Street Fighting Man.
No. I can't think of the song. Having a brain fart.
Satisfaction.
Satisfaction, right.
No, that's a Maestro Fuzz FZ1.
No, but he recorded it in the middle of the night on a cassette recorder.
I thought that was Street Fighting Man.
Okay. We're going to have to go back and look that up. I'm pretty sure it was Satisfaction. We'll have to go back.
Yes.
Okay.
Put it in the comments below.
Put it in the comments below, and you can curse us out as well for not knowing. and once you and I, whoever's right, we'll have to get the other one a slice of pizza. Sound good?
Sound good.
Okay. Unfortunately, we're going to have that pizza in Dallas. But whatever. Let's see here. Blue Cheer released the first metal record. Okay, we got to really look this up now. Okay. Did they really? I mean, honestly, I'm leaning more towards that in a sense from a real proto standpoint, you know, if we were to look at it. But there's no way, I can't see how Blue Cheer might have inspired Tony Iommi.
I think that he was completely original just out of necessity, right, honestly, because of the hand injury.
Right.
But I don't hear their influence on Iommi, but I hear Iommi's influence on everybody else that we've talked
about. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So I feel like Blue Cheer is more that 60s garage rock kind of vibe versus heavy metal.
And go on with this guy's list here. His name, I don't know if I should, I'm just going to say his name is Mike. I'm not going to mention his last name. The Who pioneered guitar destruction.
See, I had them on a side note as the concept record.
Yes. I would totally agree with that. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Jimi Hendrix pioneered advanced guitar techniques and feedback manipulation. Yoko Ono pioneered new wave.
Okay, I'm going to go with that as yes. There you go.
I would agree. Death, the metal band from Washington, D.C., invented hardcore punk, first all-black punk band. I don't know if you've ever seen the documentary on them. It's phenomenal. They were a great band. Great band. The Wipers released the first grunge record. Now I'm interested.
See, I'm not familiar with them.
I'm not familiar with them, no. I would love to sit down with this guy. A Glenn Branca Orchestra pioneered alternate tunings and prepared guitar techniques.
Never heard of that either.
No, but I'm going to be looking that up. So, yeah, there's all this stuff. I mean, I thought he was the best out of everybody. One guy wrote here, Elvis made it sexy. Jimmy made it abstract. SRV raised the bar for decades. And let's see here. Somebody wrote here, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, Dire Straits, Pink Floyd, and, of course, the Beatles. Okay, Pink Floyd, they were that derivative of psychedelic rock. Right.
And
they started out as a psych band. So, actually, no, they didn't. That's wrong. That's incorrect. They started out as a pop band, you know, with like stuff like See Emily Play and stuff like that.
Right.
And then later, as Sid became more and more fucked up.
Yeah. Then they became a psych band. Then they became a proggy band.
Yeah.
You know, with the whole concept down, but the Who beat them to the concept idea.
Yes. I would agree.
I think Jethro Tull might have beat them, too.
I can't wait to see the comments.
I'm scared to see the comments.
Nah, I'm always okay with that. I could take a good beating. Let's see here. Oh, this is a good one. ABBA, Bee Gees, Beatles, Elvis, Mariah, Led Zeppelin, Rolling Stones, Xtina, Madonna, Duran Duran, Genesis, and David Bowie. Wow. That's eclectic.
They're all legit, but guitar-centric, we were trying to say.
Right, which we, and that's what I said in here, but people don't follow directions. They follow their heart, man. Okay, let's see here.
But that list isn't wrong.
No, it's not wrong. There are no wrong lists.
Right.
That's the beauty of it all. But if we give you a criteria, can you try and stay in the box? You know, everybody always says spilling out of the box. The box always overflows. Let's see here. What else we got here? Les Paul, David Bowie, The Beatles, Yardbirds, Led Zeppelin, Bob Dylan. Bob Dylan is really someone we should talk about. He did play guitar. And he took folk and electrified it.
He did.
You know? So there's...
For me, with Bob Dylan is... And I like Bob Dylan, but I like his music done by other people.
Because of his voice?
I guess. I don't know. It's just something, yes. I like his songs. I love them when they're covers.
Yeah. I think he's one of the greatest American songwriters.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Let's see what else we got here. Some guy wrote, all the boomer stuff above. here's a real metalhead. Motorhead, Primus, Sabbath. Primus is an interesting band to talk about in the sense that they are, they're three-piece, so there's a power trio. They're the cream of their generation in
right.
some respects.
But the only thing that, because I thought about Primus, and I couldn't come up with anybody else that sounds like them where you'd be like, oh, they influence. They're just them. Do you know what I mean? Like, when you listen, you don't sit there and say, that band sounds like Primus. Nobody sounds like Primus. Mm-hmm. I couldn't think of anybody personally. So that's what left them like, so they're the architects of a genre that they're the only ones in that genre.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's see here.
And I mean, I love Primus. I just can't think of anybody else that does what Primus does where you'd be like, oh, Primus was the first.
Well,
they're the first, the last thus far for
you
me.
You can go back to, you know, Adrian Belew era Crimson in some respects.
I get to a point. I mean, yet the Tony Levin, you know,
yeah.
influence on, is there.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Somebody wrote here, Polyphia quite literally out Steve Vai'd Steve Vai.
Steve Vai might actually tell you that too.
Well, he's on the record, so yeah. So I think so. Somebody wrote Zappa and the Mothers. There really wasn't anything him. Like that beforehand. I mean, with the exception right. of 13th Floor Elevators.
Right.
You know.
Well, that's why I wrote. I went with them instead. He was on my list as a side note.
Yeah, and you know, Captain Beefheart. So okay, let's do the Mount Rushmore. Your Mount Rushmore of electric guitarists. Mine, you're going to be very unhappy with, but especially the last one. But go ahead.
Okay, my personal Mount Rushmore
mm-hmm. of electric guitarists.
Yeah, Eddie Van Halen.
Okay,
number one for me. Then Ritchie Blackmore.
Okay.
Okay, then SRV.
Really?
Yeah, out of he actually is bigger to me than Hendrix. I mean, Hendrix, when I discovered Hendrix when I was first playing guitar, I would tie freaking ties around my head to make it look like a headband and play around my room jumping around. So, I mean, I was way into Hendrix, but then when I got into Stevie, I was like, I don't know. There's something else there that is just when
yeah,
I play.
Albert King. That's what else.
Yeah. Well, then basically it's like Buddy Guy versus Albert King when you go.
Yeah.
All
yeah.
just fired yeah. up Buddy Guy.
Yeah.
And so then is Buddy Guy the architect instead of Hendrix?
I think you're right. Yeah.
But when I think about when I actually sit and play, what I hear come out is it's Eddie. There's a lot of Ritchie Blackmore. There's a lot of Stevie Ray. And then, honestly, it's Warren Haynes.
Interesting.
In my personal playing, because I rake a certain way, mm-hmm. and I got that directly from seeing the Allman Brothers bands like 25 years ago as a kid, and watching him, the way that he raked and hit notes when he went to bend, and that fat sound. It's what I always strive to get. And I notice it when I play that I inherently have lifted that from him.
Okay. So that's your Mount Rushmore.
That's my Mount Rushmore, personally, okay. of influence.
Okay. For me, and shouldn't be in any particular order, but it kind of is, Les Paul.
Okay.
Jimi Hendrix. Mm-hmm. Eddie Van Halen. And a man who never played guitar, never played a note, Leo Fender.
So I have him on another list.
Okay. He never played a note. I mean, all these other guys couldn't have really done what they did without Leo Fender. So he's got to go on the Mount Rushmore of guitar.
Right. So I did. That was my personal on my playing Mount Rushmore. Then I got other Mount Rushmore.
As you hear the card again.
So
snapping
I had
the card.
for just guitar playing guitar players, a Mount Rushmore should be Eddie Van Halen,
yeah,
Hendrix, Clapton, Les Paul.
Hmm.
For all the obvious reasons that we stated throughout the whole show.
Right.
But now let's get into the rest of these. All right.
You want to do the guitar? You want to do the electric guitars?
Yeah, I got the guitar builders. Let's just do
guitars, the models.
That one, I can do that. Hold on. You go first.
All right. For me, it's the Strat, the Les Paul, the Tele, and the PRS Custom 24.
See, that's pretty good. I have everything similar, except I was going with the ES-335 instead of the PRS.
Oh, yeah, that's... But unless you have the really fine ear, like you, who has the fine ear, can most people tell the difference between a Les Paul and an ES-335? I mean, for that matter, can they really tell the difference between an ES-335 and a PRS?
So. Right, exactly. So I just thought that I actually don't know what I thought, because you're right. The PRS is so versatile and so milestone-ish. There's been nothing else after it, really.
No, there hasn't.
It should be there. And I like Tellys more than Strats, so maybe I remove the Strat and I put the PRS there and I keep the 335, because I think the 335 is important.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's hear the rest of your lists.
Okay.
Are you mad?
So I got for guitar builders.
Ah, here we go.
Rushmore. You need Leo Fender there.
Absolutely.
You need Ted McCarty, because there's no Les Paul Flying V Explorer, any of that, without Ted McCarty.
Absolutely.
Paul Reed Smith, because he innovated, the original Custom 24 was so innovative.
Absolutely.
And Les Paul, because he's the one that prodded everybody to, hey, let's just build this thing out of solid wood.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Then my next Mount Rushmore was for amp builders.
Okay.
I went with Leo Fender, because everybody loves a Fender and copies a Fender. I went with Jim Marshall, because he's the father of Loud, which he was influenced by Leo Fender, because the original stuff was Leo Fender's stuff. Then Randall Smith, because Boogie was the first boutique, amp builder. Then Hartley Peavy, because everybody has or has had a Peavy.
Absolutely. I almost bought one again the other day.
Really?
I almost bought a Bandit the other day.
Oh my God, they're so good though.
They are so great. A great amp. What about Vox?
I felt that Marshall was bigger than Vox, and I thought the other two were more important, because, like I said, everybody has a PV, and he got really great equipment. I mean, I know sometimes it's ugly, and people rag on PVs here and there, but they don't break. They're so gig-worthy, and they sound good.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? So the two that I have, I love.
Yeah.
So, I left Vox off because that's a little more... And I love Vox, but it's a little more... I don't know how I would put it. It's its own thing. It's not as big to me as Defender and the Marshall. And
okay.
Like I said, and Mesa Boogies, those are on everything. Mm-hmm. If any one of these things I listed is on most recordings.
Mm-hmm.
So... then I had innovative guitar builders. So, like, guys who did weird stuff. It was Ned Steinberger, because he changed trim systems, the whole headless thing, right? Grover Jackson, because Jackson-style stuff was everywhere. Even though I had him listed with Wayne Charvel, but on Mount Rushmore, you can only have four. And I didn't want to make him some kind of two-headed mutant, so I dropped Wayne Charvel. I have Bernie Rico, because that was like BC Rich's with the Nectar and the crazy electronics, right? And then I've told you about this guy before. Most people might not know him, but Roger Rosmael. He was the guy from Rickenbacker who designed everything that we know about Rickenbacker.
Mm-hmm.
So it was the first neck through bass, all the 330 and this and that. And he actually went on to work for Fender and designed the Coronados.
I did not know that.
Yeah. So I would have to put him up there for weird, innovative stuff, not, okay. not your typical guy stuff. Mm-hmm. So
what about no Seth Lover?
Honorable mention people.
Okay, honorable. Okay, let's hear.
Seth Lover for the PAF.
Right.
Seymour Duncan for basically boutique pickups. Mm-hmm. Right. Ernie Ball for taking banjo strings and packaging banjo strings for rock and roll. Mm-hmm. I didn't write a fourth one. So you could throw in a fourth one.
Bob Kaler.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Definitely consider him.
Well, what about Floyd Rose then?
Well, yeah, I expected to hear that in there. Floyd Rose definitely needs to go in there. I mean, he really should be in the Mount Rushmore in some respects because, you know, you can't go anywhere now and not get a guitar with a freaking Floyd Rose on it.
Right.
You know?
Still.
You almost have to order it special. You know, right. It's like no onions, no Floyd Rose. Hold the mayo. Hold the Floyd.
Oh, man.
How many guitars do you own with a Floyd Rose?
Oh, man. I got to own like at least 10 or 15 of them with Floyd Roses. With
Floyd Rose. Ask me how many I have.
How many do you have of Floyd Rose?
Not a single one.
And I hate them. I don't hate them. Like, they do their thing really good. I just don't use trim a lot.
Yeah.
It's just, you know how hard it is to find like a Jackson without a Floyd Rose?
It's
like,
impossible.
I wait to find my Rhodes. Like, everyone had a Floyd Rose. I had to wait for one that came, you know, with a neck through.
I was so lucky to find a dinky with just a regular Fulcrum trim on it.
Right. It's so much better, too. I hate dealing with locking mechanisms. Like, I recently acquired a Satriani Ibanez. And the guy that I got it from has it set up to E flat. So mm-hmm. it's all set up to E flat. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I wanted to put it in standard. And I'm like, I don't feel like undoing everything. So it's just going to stay locked until it needs strings.
I'm just lazy.
Yeah. I look at it and I'm like,
I hear you, man. I hear you. You remember back in the 80s, I was using Kaler exclusively. I was an endorser and all that stuff, and loved them because they were easy, they were simple. Yeah, still took a whole shitload of wood out of the guitar, but they were easy, and they had that at the headstock. They had that flip top for the changing the strings easy.
Yep.
You know, and there was a flathead screw at the top, but it was cool because when you flipped up the top and pressed on the screw would give way, and it would it would make it so the string could come out no problem, just like a normal nut. And then you just give it a little turn, and then flip the lid again. And all the guitars I had any guitar that I had with a Kaler had that flip top, and it was extra. It cost extra to get that flip top thing, but man, that thing was great. But if your headstock banged into something, whatever, that flip top was made of this kind of brushed aluminum. And I had one where they snapped off. It broke in the middle. So it was a real bitch to, you would always hurt your finger when you had to pull it up and stuff like that.
Right.
And getting, you know, because it was all put in there, it was all very tight construction, to go and change that little lid, forget about it. You just have to go get an entire new nut. But I loved it. I love that setup. That was a great setup. And I found, I think with all locking tremolo systems, you end up sacrificing some tone. Mm-hmm. But I think, at least from my ears, I felt like I lost less tone with the Kaler than I did with the Floyd Rose. I had a Steve Stevens model, Hamer.
Oh, nice guitar.
Yeah, I had one of those for about 2 years, and it had the Floyd Rose, and I just could never get it to sound right. I hated changing the strings, you know. It was a pain in the ass. I also do not like the idea that we're drilling two massive holes at the weakest point in a neck.
Right.
That to me is completely counterproductive for the instrument. Tone, from a tone standpoint, and from a
integrity of the
integrity of the structure of the neck, which is one of the weakest points on the guitar. I'd love to talk to Paul about that.
Yeah.
You know, because he is so detailed about every single, I mean, you know, the nut, the everything, every single screw, he truly believes is part of the tone. And he educated me that way. I never, until speaking with him about that and him walking me through that and yelling at me through the whole thing, I did not really think about it, but he's completely right. Which is why I think he's the finest guitar builder in the 20th and 21st century.
Oh yeah, I just wish that he would. How do I put this nicely? He was very innovative. I loved the old, like I love the rotary knob custom 24s and the original McCartys and all that. Mm-hmm. And now he's just giving you. And I own PRSs, so. Don't send hate mail. I love PRSs, but
so
I feel like newer stuff is he's giving me a Strat. They're hinting a Tele is coming. He's giving you what we already got, just with him giving his like stamp of like this is better because I like.
I'm starting to understand his modus operandi.
Mm-hmm.
Do I necessarily agree with it entirely? No, I, you know, but once again, it's in the world of commerce and, you know, in business, you adapt or die.
I know. And that's the thing with guitar players. We don't want anything past 1959.
Which is
maybe
really pathetic.
But it's like,
you know.
And you know who's not like that? Bass players. No, I'm a bass player in the, you know, I play out. That's a bass player and this and that. And I like wacky stuff on my basses and I like, you know, wacky woods and mm-hmm. let's try this and that. Mm-hmm. But like, if you're like, pick guitar, I'm like, Les Paul, straight mm-hmm. up, just like it was in the 50s. Don't change anything or I won't buy it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's interesting, like that thought process. But bass player be like, check this out. This is made out of some crazy wood. It's got a billion strings on it mm-hmm. and crazy active electronics and people are like, wow, that's so innovative and cool. But guitar players are like fickle. We're like, is that a 1963? No, 62. Don't make it past 62. September of 62, to be honest. So it's like really crazy.
Yeah, I hear you. Yeah, I'm always looking forward to something new. Like I thought, that's why I thought, like I got excited with Vega Trem. I thought that was really a cool idea.
That is awesome. I
really
love that
smart
Nelly trim setup thing that they got going on.
And what's happening in the world of pedals, I think, is exciting too.
That's a whole different.
We're having a new renaissance with pedals, but not with guitars.
No, guitars are very stale.
Yeah.
It's very like, but again, so that's where I feel with PRS is like, you know, the Silver Sky is cool. I liked it when he did the DC3. Which is the predecessor, mm-hmm. you know? And actually, if you go way back, I liked it when he did the EGs, which were, you know, the EG.
Uh-huh.
He built a Strat in the early 90s that was called the EG.
Mm-hmm.
Cool guitar. Silver Sky,
right.
So much like a Strat. I mean, I played them. I like them. I'm not saying I'll never own one, but I'm like, what's innovative about this?
Yeah. You know? I think, you know, I do hear a difference with those pickups.
Oh, they sound great.
Yeah, it's completely different. You can get your Strat thing happening, but it's also got something else. It's got a different tonal quality.
And they're very consistent sounding.
They're completely balanced. That's the difference. That's what he did. They're balanced across the spectrum. So, yeah. So you know, we'll see. I'm you know, like I said, I'm looking forward. I'm hoping for a left-handed DGT SE. And that'll be my next purchase. Plus that SG Junior.
That's what you need. That was hot.
we always send pictures of each guitars to each other, and it's like, oh, what do you think about this? So that's probably next in line. So here we go. I got. Are you done with all of your
Mount
Rushmores? Okay. So here's. I went to social media again. because that's where everything means everything to everybody, he said sarcastically. I asked the question, what's your guitarist Mount Rushmore, and what's your electric guitarist Mount Rushmore, and electric guitar Mount Rushmore. Here's what I got. One guy wrote, Rory Gallagher and my telly.
That's all you need.
One guy wrote, four Dave Mustaines.
Flying V's or four Dave Mustaines?
Four Dave Mustaines on Mount Rushmore. That's very funny.
How quickly would that band break up?
They'd all be in court with each other. All right. A good friend of ours, Thomas Dennett. You know Thomas?
Yes.
Right. He wrote EVH and a Stratocaster. That was it. Ty Tabor, Phil Keggy, Mark Knopfler, Sean Lane. We didn't talk about Sean Lane.
Yeah.
And SRV. Here somebody wrote, Les Paul, Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, Joe Bonamassa. And for guitars, he wrote Gibson Les Paul, PRS Custom, Fender Strat, Fender Tele. Joe Bonamassa? Mount Rushmore? Okay.
I think that goes again with the age thing. If he's a younger guy, maybe that's what he knows, you know.
Yeah, okay. Let's see here. Chet Atkins, Jimi Hendrix, Eddie Van Halen, and B.B. King. That's interesting. And guitars was Tele, Strat, Les Paul, and a Martin D28. Now,
see, I have that on. I had a little side note of acoustic guitars.
Yeah, I specifically said here to this gentleman, Don, I specifically said electric guitars. But yes, you can't ignore the Martin D28. Let's see here. Doyle Bramhall II, Tony Emmanuel, acoustic guitar, Derek Trucks, Monty Montgomery, and then LP, Les Paul, Telecaster, Taylor Acoustic, and a Dobro. Come on, guys. Can we get directions? Please follow directions. Okay. Jimi Hendrix, Duane Allman, Jimmy Page, Roy Buchanan. Strat, Tele, Les Paul, D28 again. Somebody just wrote Fender Mustang, Fender Jazz Master, Hallmark 60 Custom, and a Fender Jagstang. Hallmark 60 Custom.
It's like a surf style guitar,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's a 60s. Yeah.
Like that swept wing looking?
Yeah, kind of.
Thing?
Yeah. So let's see here. What else we got? Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, SRV, Billy Duffy from The Cult. And then Strat, Les Paul, SG, and a Gretsch White Falcon. Well, we know where the Gretsch White Falcon came from.
The man's guitar.
That's right. Let's see here. Django, Wes Montgomery, Danny Gatton, Hank Garland, 335 Les Paul, Strat, and a Tele. So that was yours.
Yeah.
Somebody wrote here, John Frusciante, Eric Johnson, Jimmy Page, and Pat O'Brien. That's interesting.
Pat O'Brien?
Yeah.
Who's he?
I don't know.
Oh, I'm going to have to look him up.
Yeah. Let's see here. Gilmore, Vi, Nuno, Friedman, Gibson Les Paul, Gibson ES-335, Fender Strat, Fender Tele. Let's see here. Taylor Swift.
She sold a lot of guitars.
And Donner Guitars. I've been seeing reviews on Donner guitars. I got to go play one. I want to play one because people are saying how great they are for the money.
Really?
That's what I've been hearing.
I mean, I played their pedals.
I have one of their pedals. I actually have that multiple delay thing and the reverse delay on there.
Right.
I love that. That's a cool sound. You should get that pedal. It's a fun pedal.
I'll have to look it up.
For $29. Let's see here. Dwayne Allman, Jerry Garcia, Pat Metheny, Tommy Emmanuel, and Steve Kimock. K-I-M-O-C-K. I don't know that person.
I know him. I think he's a solo guy.
I'm definitely going to go check him out.
He's really good.
Hendrix, Page, Clapton, and Slash.
You know, I had Slash on a side note, but he didn't really architect anything other than being a pop icon and selling a lot of Les Pauls.
Right.
When he plays, I hear Joe Perry, I hear Johnny Thunders, mm-hmm.
I hear Joe Perry, Jimmy Page, I hear Johnny Thunders. Yeah, absolutely. No, he's not an architect. No. Great guitar player. An amazing ambassador for the guitar.
Absolutely.
But not an architect. No.
Changed commerce. Well, maybe because he changed commerce.
He did. Yeah, he did.
You know.
But he's not ringing all the bells.
No.
Yeah, no.
No one's freely.
And I think, right. And I think that he would agree.
Yeah, I think that you're right.
He's a very modest gentleman. And he's a gentleman. Yeah, for sure. Well, that's what I got.
Cool.
There we are.
I think that for all the people that didn't listen and wrote acoustic guitar stuff, I should do my Mount Rushmore of acoustic guitar people.
Okay, do it. Let's hear it.
You got D.F. Martin, right? The original C.F. Martin.
Yeah.
Bob Taylor.
Yeah, absolutely.
Taylor guitars were innovative.
Yeah, absolutely.
Orville Gibson.
Yes.
With his arch top acoustics that he had made.
Out of Western New York.
And Kamen. I forget, was it Bill Kamen or whatever his name was?
Kamen.
With Ovation.
Yeah. Ovation, yeah.
So that's for you acoustic people.
Yes. I love Ovation guitars.
I hate them.
Oh, my God. Why?
Oh, they always slide down on me. Like, I had that double neck.
You
just got to
put that, what's it called on there? You got to put that rubber thing onto the bottom and it won't come off.
I know. But
and they make a rubber thing for it. They just slap it on there and you're good to go.
No, I remember people used to put the skateboard tape too. On
there
it.
You go. Yeah, that'll work. I think they're a great all around guitar. I just love them. I've been playing Ovation since '78. It's my first real good acoustic guitar my dad bought me.
Funny because you're in the same age bracket as my father, and he loves Ovation. But yeah. I think it's that whole because I'm like a total like. Taylor guy.
Well, yeah, I love Taylor guitars. I think they're great. It's another great guitar company, and they're not, you know, they would even agree. They're not in the same echelon, but they're really affordable. It's a company called Mackenzie & Marr out of Canada.
You had them on years ago.
Yeah, and they're wonderful. And they're not in stores. You order direct. And they have I can't remember how long the trial period is, but it's a fairly long trial period. And if you don't like the guitar, for any reason, pack it up, send it back, they'll give you your money back.
Huh.
And
that's really standing behind your guitar.
Yeah.
Your
and product. I have the a 00 parlor guitar of theirs. And I swear to God, it's the loudest acoustic guitar I've ever played in my life. The sound just flies off of that cedar top, and it is just wonderful instrument. Really, really great. I put Kurt Mangan strings on there, acoustic guitar strings, 9-gauge.
Nice.
And it's just magnificent.
And even with the 9s, it projects that much.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a great guitar.
You'll have to send me an audio sample.
I will. It's a great guitar. They're wonderful. I love those guys. And that's such a great deal. I mean, you know, I see it. I like it. Oh, I can't try it, but I'll buy it. If I don't like it, I'll send it right back. And they'll give you all of your money back. It's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Yeah. They're not a sponsor of the show, although they should be. Well, that's it, man. Well, that's
it.
We just killed 2 hours.
It goes by so fast when we talk.
It's 2 hours you'll never get back. But that's okay.
Well, when I listen to the replay, I'll get it back.
That's true. Yeah, we got a lot of cool stuff coming up in the new year. Rob's going to join us for more stuff, I hope.
Nope, working on it.
Yep. That'll be fun. T and I were talking about doing some more gear stuff in the year, talking to more gear guys. That's definitely Rob's forte. And yeah, we got some really cool stuff coming for the new year. But this is our first episode of the new year. And thank you, sir, for being part of it.
Thank you for having me.
Wow.
I love our conversations.
Absolutely. It's a blast. Folks, we will see you on the next episode of Guitar Radio Show. Peace.
Unchained Brands. Unchainedbrands.com. Rock and roll accessories that give back. Handcrafted pendants, chains, necklaces, earrings, and wearables that symbolize the union of the music community. Unchained Brands is proud to provide a portion of their proceeds to benefit Music Cares, a nonprofit organization that provides a safety net of critical assistance, education, pathways to recovery, and support for all music people in times of need. Together, we will lead the journey to inspire through our products and our community. Come join us. Find Unchained Brands on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and at unchainedbrands.com.
Check out Guitar Radio Show on iTunes, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Stitcher Radio, guitarradioshow.com, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Find Guitar Radio Show on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. And remember, if you like the artists you hear on Guitar Radio Show, don't just stream their music, buy it.
Productions.